You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
What's new on the 42cast? Let's ask my co-hosts.
We're talking about Doctor Who,
comic book shows and movies,
and we're talking about all things Star Trek,
and so much more.
Check us out on Google Play, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
It's only on the 42cast, your ultimate answer to fandom, geekiness, and everything.
So Nathan, when are we finally talking Babylon 5?
Hey, everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. Mark Maddox is back with us again this week, as promised. Well, he's making faces that you can't see because this is not a video podcast.
You're a liar.
Trying to crack me up here, but we're going to be talking about a film we've talked about on and on amongst ourselves, but we've never brought it out to do a show on it, and that is based on the H.P. Lovecraft novel, Die, Monster, Die.
Well, it's not based on the H.P.
Lovecraft novel. The novel isn't Die, Monster, Die. That's what...
It's actually a short story. Medium short story. Color Out of Space.
Color Out of Space.
Yes. Kalur.
Kalur.
Which, while you read it, you drink liqueur.
Yeah, the British
you drink
spell,
liqueur yes. As you read Kalur Out of Space. It's Die Monster Die. What year is it? 65?
Well, it was, you know, now the interesting thing was it was released later in the UK. It was shot in 64,
but they didn't,
they didn't release it in the UK until 1966. United States, we got it on October 27th of 1965, which happened to be my sister's, let's see, how old would she have been? Well, I won't give her age out, but she's younger than me. She's a couple years younger than me, but it was one of her birthdays.
She, the reason that it didn't make it to Britain until 66 is probably because every theater on the planet was still showing Sound of Music.
It's an amicus. Yeah, they might not have been able to afford to get into any of the theaters that were showing Sound of Music.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, once again, this comes back to the whole business of, oh, well, we've got this movie. It's been sitting here. We finally got a spot for it.
Yeah.
Well, let's drop it in. I mean, this is not a major motion picture.
No, it wasn't. But, I'm a big fan of Amicus Productions and,
This is an amicus. I don't think is
I believe it,
it
is.
I thought it was American International.
American International really was the distributor for the United States, but Anglo Amalgamated in the UK. No, I stand corrected. It was Alta Vista. I kept thinking this was Amicus for some reason. I don't know why I thought that.
Okay. I'm not going to.
I make mistakes. I think comes with age.
I'm not going to rub it in.
Yeah,
I am. You were wrong.
I was wrong. I was wrong on that one. I think I've done two amicuses in a row, and I just was in an amicus mood.
Yeah, you had said it too many times. You're walking around in your sleep going amicus. Amicus.
Yeah, because last week we did the Land That Time Forgot, and then
without me.
And then, I know. We'll do the people that time forgot.
You'll have to beat me here.
I'll bring in for that one there.
I don't want to do the people that time forgot. I wanted to do Land That Time Forgot.
Yeah, fun movie.
All right. Well, anyway, back to this non-amicus feature.
Die, Monster, Die. Yes, or otherwise.
Die, Monster, Die.
This is going to be my life story with Monster Attack, as written by Mark Maddox, if I leave him out of any more movies.
The suspense novel, The Amicus Failure.
Yeah, The Amicus. Oh, that's a great title. I like that.
That's what I'm here for. Great titles.
Man, that's good.
I think this movie is a little better than its title.
I agree.
I think the title's sort of just like, what can we call it? And unlike something like, which would almost come across as cheesy, something like Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed, which has the movie to back up that title,
Yes.
this movie deserves something a little more something, a little more eloquent. I don't know. It just Die Monster Die is
No,
so.
I agree. It
I
should
mean,
have
it could have
outer
been,
space. It should have outer space in the title
or
somewhere
something, or
because, you know,
something,
something.
yeah, something, something having to do with the color out of space is a very poetic sounding thing. I don't even know if it would.
Yeah, I love it.
I don't
Yeah.
think that, but I don't think it would be a very good movie title back in the 60s. You could, I mean, they did it. Of course, they redid it again, what, 3, 4 years ago with Nicolas Cage, and they called it Color Out of Space.
Yeah.
But it needed a punchy title. But I think Die Monster Die to me is just not fair to the film in a way. I
I
don't.
know I saw this for the first time, you know, and I was let's see, it showed up around 67 or 68, I think, on one of the, I think it was on, I believe it was on Monster Movie Matinee. I think it was one of the daytime ones. Because like I said, yeah, like you were saying, it was not a big release, so it didn't make like the CBS late night or something like that.
No.
But you know, so I was probably in seventh or eighth grade when I saw it, and
Yeah.
it caught me a little off guard that I was waiting for the monster, but then I liked the movie. I mean, when I finally got around to, you know, letting you know what was going on. By the way, folks, we will let you know what's going on. So if you have not seen this movie, you may want to wait right now and pause the podcast and
Yeah,
go
we are
check it out.
we're gonna tell you everything in
Going
the
to tell you
film that
everything.
we can
That's
think
right.
of, you know.
Easy to find. This one's a very, very easy one to find. So.
Well, it's also too, I saw it from, I want to say, from Washington, D.C. television, the Superstation
I
Channel
would have guessed you would have
20.
seen it at that station, yeah.
Right. And it was and they also used it. There's a scene from the movie that they used, and I can't remember. It wasn't Sir Graves Gasly, I don't think was on anymore. The feed that they got from Detroit, it was
Yeah,
out of
yeah.
Washington. As you know, he was a Detroit horror
Right.
show host, but he syndicated down to DC for a couple of years, and I think this might have been after he was gone from there. And it had, I think it was an ad for, what the heck was the name of it? Monster Matinee, or I forget what the hell the name of the thing was, but they kept on week after week. Their ad was to let you know to watch this science fiction theater show
Yeah, yeah.
in the afternoon on Saturdays. Was the scene where Nick Adams is in the house and the mother, who's now turned completely mutated and
Yes.
homicidal,
Right.
attacks him, and then she falls on the ground, and then her face starts to decompose and fall apart. And that was their ad for months. That was what they used as a thing to get you to tune in.
That's a good one to get you to tune in. By the way, the mother played wonderfully by Freda Jackson,
Freda Jackson,
old
who
Hammer favorite.
is one of the great heroes or heroines
Oh my God, yeah.
of the movie Brides of Dracula.
I was
One
going to
of,
say that's. I mean, that's the movie I will always think of her in, with that laugh that she
yeah,
had,
she's
the
one of the
evil
only
laugh
people
that
that
she
can
had.
do a crazy laugh like
Oh my
that
God, she
and
was
get away
great.
with it. Most
Yeah.
people, man, most people do that, and it's like, oh, brother,
Yep.
you know, the maniacal laugh. But man, hers is genuinely horrifying.
Very,
Great
very. It's,
actress.
yeah. All right.
Great actress, did a
Oh
great
yeah,
job.
she appeared
But
in a ton of horror films
and
from
in
that
this
time
movie
period.
they kind of kept her hid. I mean,
Oh
basically
yeah.
this is one of those, the guy shows up in the village, little English village, and starts asking for a particular household, and nobody wants to point him there. Gee, have we
Yeah.
ever never heard that before?
Yeah.
They don't want to tell you where the house is.
They don't even want to
It's
mention the
they yeah they
name.
get mad. They won't rent you a bicycle or nothing. Nobody will
Yeah.
drive you to the place. So you have to walk in your Dick Tracy outfit
Yeah.
over to the, that's Nick Adams in a trench coat.
Well, I mean, that was hot as I had a trench coat at that time. I mean,
Yeah. Oh, of
everybody had them.
course.
I
Oh
mean,
yeah, it
mid
was a great.
'60s, and I think with the rise of the spy stuff and all that stuff,
Oh, it looked good.
it was great, man. I loved it. Yeah, I had a black trench coat, and it was years before I realized why it was called a trench coat that it had to do with World War I. But I mean, yeah,
Yeah,
other than
yeah,
that,
yeah.
but I loved it. Yeah, they were very popular.
Nick Adams is our good guy in this, or
Yeah.
as Ed, what the hell's the name of the actor from The Right Stuff, who played
Oh, Ed Harris?
Ed Harris. Ed Harris. Is that what I am? A hairy hair shirt?
Yeah.
Hairy attaboy.
That's right.
Whatever. He's that. I mean, that's the reason that he played good guys in the Japanese monster movies and stuff too, like Frankenstein Conquers the World. And
then of course, about this time they got him because of Renegade and some of the TV work he'd done.
And you know, and he had done stuff with James Dean and all that. I mean, he was he's a little more straightforward of an actor than a lot of those guys, but he's a good guy when he's Mr. Astronaut. He's Mr. Hero. You know, he's, and in this movie, he's of that ilk where he's just a real good guy who happens to be in love with this one girl that he met in college. And now she's gone back home and he goes to visit her. And what does he do? He shows up at this creepy house or whatever with Boris Karloff telling him to go away. The great Boris Karloff.
Go away.
Yeah, that was pretty good, Jim.
After offering him some untaped pasta.
You got to cut that part.
We'll cut that part.
Yeah, we'll cut that.
That was pretty bad.
But
who wouldn't be in love with Susan Farmer? I mean, you know, Dracula, Prince of Darkness. I think that's where I really fell in love with her.
In love with every woman on the planet. She played
Frances Matthews' wife, you know,
you haven't met Richard Clemenson, I don't think.
But I have not met Richard in person. I know who he is.
I think
we've corresponded a couple of times.
Well, he's a great guy, and he runs one of the greatest magazines ever for film, Little Shop of Horrors magazine, which I am currently doing a cover for of Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell. But He, I believe, if I remember correctly, I think he dated her for a while.
I don't know.
Yeah, but she's...
she was married to Ian McShane back in the 60s, but then she's been single, or she was single.
Well, I think she's passed now, isn't she?
No, she passed in 2017, but I said she remained single after she divorced Ian McShane. She never got married again, but she had relationships.
Right. Yeah. And... But she's in there. She's very, very much a product of the 60s with her style and clothing and her hair and that. She's got the, what do you call that? Is that called a bob? What's the bob?
Well, I know. I used to always call that a hair flip, you know, the little at the end, how
right
up at the end, but might be a bob. Yeah.
She's the one there. I mean, Karloff and her definitely, you know, can come across as British. Nick Adams plays an American, so he doesn't have to try.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you've got some other really good actors in there, like we said, Frida and Patrick McGee, who I
absolutely
wish had a bigger part. I mean, he had a little part. What a great actor.
He's absolutely.
His voice just is almost like electrical or something.
And the screen presence, I know, like, just even though in A Clockwork Orange he's not in it a lot, he totally takes this that movie over.
Oh, or the scene in Chariots of Fire where they're trying to convince that guy to run on Sunday and he won't do it for religious beliefs, you know, try to get this man to change his mind. And it's like, oh my gosh, he would just
show up and just
dominated his great, absolutely. Speaking of Amicus, his great scene, a great episode of Tales from the Cryptus, the blind leader of the blind guys
and what
they do to the guy that runs the place. He's good. He's a really good actor. Yeah. And the scenery is real beautiful. The village that they shot in, or villages, I don't know if it was in one spot or not. But
yeah, I don't know. It looked familiar. I mean, it's one that they've used in other films. I mean, I kept saying I've seen this in other movies or bits and pieces of it in other movies. But yeah, it's perfect. It was perfect.
Well, it's one of those where the original novella, or book, short story, whatever the heck. I'm tired of trying to. Okay, it's called The Story. It takes place in the United States, but it's in a part where, you know, it's an older part of the United States, so it can have that kind of gothic feel. In this case of filming in England, boom, you're right there. You've got the age to give it more of a presence. But so Nick Adams shows up and Karloff doesn't want him to stay, but his girlfriend wants him to stay. And then he meets the mother, who we really don't see, Frida Jackson. They hide her through the whole film. Yep. She's usually in bed with a curtain in front of it. You can barely see through her presence or whatever, and she's like wanting him, Nick Adams, to get the daughter out of there, and Karloff is like the opposite about it. And yeah, she's it was a shame, because I would have liked to have seen her, but that's not the point. The point of this movie is that when you finally do see her, especially when she's in full mutated, horrifically messed up mode, that's because she was supposed to be close to that. Unfortunately for me, the other night I watched it on a very high definition television, big, with a Blu-ray copy, and you can pretty much see that's her behind the curtain with no makeup on, just doing her lines. But, you know, still great to see her even in that little bit.
Well, I think, you know, that the fact that she has to get the character across with just words and not really much visual. It says a lot about the performance she gives, because
great.
It's a powerful, powerful performance. And without being seen, I agree with you. It would have liked to have seen her more, but it would have ruined the whole movie.
It would have been.
It would have given it all away before they were ready to give it away.
She's memorable. I mean, I remember her
absolutely
the first time ever seeing the film and enjoying her performance. And anyway, so there's this thing where you find out that if at first you get this feeling, is this some kind of spooky, ooky ghost story thing first? Yeah. And it isn't. It's really a science fiction story, which has got horrific results.
Yeah, you almost think it's some kind of curse thing or something.
Yeah, horror. It's a horror science. Well, yeah, they even say that the earlier family was very religious and cultish. They had a cult going on and everything. And turns out that there is a meteor that had landed years earlier and had messed with the landscape
quite a bit.
Now this is where I'm doing a little bit here of mixing too. In the novella, the meteor kind of takes over the plant life in the area. It's just new, unusual forms of plants and stuff that seem to take on a life of their own. There are colors that are visible that people have never seen before. Anyway, so the plant life and everything gets affected by it. Animals get affected by it. They start seeing weird things in the woods for one of the first things they see is a rabbit that's jumping way too far and long and wide for a normal animal of that type. And they also leave things out. There's a scene where one of the characters goes in a room and sees this guy's wife, and he never described what she looks like. Basically, the guy goes in, looks, and sees her mutated, and then leaves and closes the door, and never describes it because it's so disturbing.
Oh, wow.
So that sort of leaves your imagination to run wild. So it's quite a bit different. In the case of this meteor, it was more, how would you say it? It was more, it burned up the land. Things got destroyed.
Yeah. I mean, it almost looked like a nuclear bomb went off around the area or something. You know, when he first shows up and, Daniel Haller, who was the director, also directed a movie we talked about between ourselves, the Dunwich Horror. He's the one who directed that one as well.
Oh, okay.
When Nick Adams' character is walking through this, I mean, pure destruction, it looks like. It's all burned up, and he grabs this twig off of what looks like a small tree, and it just disintegrates to dust. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you almost think major fire or some kind of explosion. Or, you know, first thing I thought, nuclear. I don't know why. I guess because in the 60s. That's what everyone thought.
Well, I mean, it does.
You know, that's what was on our minds so much. So
sure. Yeah, and so you know, we come to find out that it's polluted the land and everything, and created, and it's like Karloff's butler and stuff keeps collapsing and stuff because for some reason he is sick.
Something's going on with him. That's for sure.
And then there's even scenes in the film where Nick Adams is walking along and gets attacked by a woman with a knife, who at first, as a kid, I thought that was Freda Jackson as well. It turned out not to be. It was one of the maids or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. What was her name? I can't think of her name. Anyway, yes, it was one of the maids that they make reference to her a few times during the movie that she'd disappeared or whatever.
But, right, and she was out there.
Yeah, you know. I thought I was with you. I thought it was the mother too, because she was in a big hood or a big, you know.
Yeah, and later you realize, you know, when I was watching it, that they called out the other woman's name and everything like that. So, you know, this is an unusual film.
Helga was the name of the maid.
Right. It's interesting to me because there is a little bit of Hammer DNA on this one. One of them is
absolutely,
the musical score.
Yeah. Yes.
The guys that worked on that. I mean, it sounds a whole heck of a lot. I know Philip Martell, I can't remember who actually did the score, but
Don Banks wrote the music, but Philip Martell was the musical supervisor.
Okay. And so was it both of them that worked on Evil of Frankenstein? Because the music is almost,
I believe it's got that written all over it. Banks did work on Evil of Frankenstein as well.
Yeah. And the fact that you've got Freda Jackson, Patrick McGee, and stuff like that in this movie, I mean, just more of it. And it's shot in England. It has a little bit of an overlap with
that feel.
And Les Bowie did the opening credits,
yeah,
the special effects man for a lot of Hammer films. There is some DNA overlap of Hammer with this one.
Yeah.
The difference is that this one's got Karloff. This one, Karloff never made a Hammer film, which I think I would have liked to have seen that.
I would have too. Yeah, yeah. Especially after... Of course, you know, and as folks listening know, I'm a huge fan of Black Sabbath or the Italian, the Italian version of it, Three Faces of Evil. And Karloff was just brilliant in that.
So one time Karloff,
nice to have seen him some more.
I think it's one of the only times Karloff actually scared me. Like as a kid, I saw it on Sunrise Theater out of North Carolina.
Yeah,
One you know very well.
And yes,
it was the one time I watched a movie where I was genuinely.
That's where I first saw it too, as well.
Him and the content bothered me.
Yeah.
So he worked with Baba. I'm surprised Hammer didn't pick him up. Was he living in England by then? I can't remember.
Yes, he was, because he was pretty ill when he made this movie. He was. They wrote the character so he was in a wheelchair,
right?
Because at this time he was having a lot of trouble walking. He was having
some. Yeah, a lot of his movies at that point were.
I mean, he would still be around for about another 7 or 8. I think it's about 7. What was it? 73 when he passed away?
No. He passed away in 69.
Okay, it was before 70. So he was going to still be around for another five years. Yeah, he had moved back to the UK in the early 1960s. Not too long before this film was made. So he was,
because I know even Christopher Lee said sometime that he got to talk to him. So I may actually work with him once on a lesser film, Crimson Cult or something like Crimson.
Yes,
Altar.
He did. I can't remember which one. It wasn't a horror
Curse film. Of the Crimson Altar. No, it was a horror film. It was Barbara Steele. Steele was in it.
Oh, that one. Lee. No, Barbara Steele. Now I know the one you're talking about. Yes.
But Christopher Lee, was really really was very pleased to be able to talk to him why didn't anybody move him over into a Hammer film? I mean,
I agree.
I mean, I'm not saying you would have to play Baron Frankenstein or anything. You already got Peter Cushing doing that. And I don't think.
No, because Hammer had some great films coming out, after this. And he would have been a welcome addition, I think.
Absolutely. Strange. Yeah. It's strange.
Hey, I never know what goes through the minds of some of these film producers.
Yeah, maybe.
They might have been afraid of his health. Whatever. Could be.
I know that he definitely was in the wheelchair in a lot of films at that time and sitting down a lot, whether it was Wild Wild West or, but it was funny too, because what was the other film where he actually walked quite a bit was Targets, where
that was a surprise. You know, knowing when I'd read about some of his health issues and knowing that, and by the way, folks, that's one we're going to be doing down the road here, that he was able to be honest, do as much in that film as he did, because he was really at the end of
I mean, well, he would make one or two more films, real stankers.
Yeah.
And which I think they slapped in some nudity in them or something too, that he didn't.
Yeah. They were like drive-in fare. They were really,
which is a shame, but it's sort of like, Peter Sellers go. Most people, even though his last film is The Fiendish Plot of Dr. Fu Manchu, most people say the film he went out with was Being There. And it's the same thing.
I do. Here, I'm one of those people. Yeah.
Here with Karloff, that they say, well, his last hurrah was targets, and the other stuff doesn't matter. And I agree with that.
I'm total agreement on that. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting seeing somebody like Nick Adams and Karloff playing off of each other. Susan Farmer in there, of course, with her beautiful British accent and everything. She sells her part very well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it turns out that the meteors created mutations and stuff that are out in the there's a greenhouse that glows at night, and he goes out there and checks it out, and there's vegetation that's huge, plants and stuff. They could not do the story. Let's be honest, they couldn't do Lovecraft's story.
It would have been
way too cost prohibitive. So they took it and they borrowed chunks of it. But then, of course, even bigger budget films do that too. I mean, look at Frankenstein, look at Dracula, look at The Shining.
Absolutely,
that don't do what books do. Well, Shining had the budget.
You just basically try to get the spirit of what the story was about, and as right, close as you can get it.
But then in this case of this one, there is no, you know, big glowing monster at the end attacking Nick. I think that was to give it a little bit of low budget punch, which I am actually kind of a fan of that scene.
I liked it a lot. Yeah. I think it added a lot. I mean, you never really see it full on. I mean, you see chunks of it, and
well, they show the silver looking thing,
just the
glowing, and they have that high pitched whine.
Right. And then they hit a filter, the explosion there, or whatever.
Yeah, they hit a filter over it, which. But it turns out that there's these weird creatures out in the greenhouse. Did they ever get rid of those things? I guess the whole
place went up in flames. So
the house did, but did the greenhouse go up in flames?
Yeah, I think the greenhouse went up as well.
Well, that's good, because there was some pretty creepy stuff.
Yeah, there's some creepy. Like. Yeah, there was. Well, you had that man-eating plant type thing or whatever, the thing that grabs Susan Farmer.
Right.
When they're
played by Jim Adams. Yeah. They ended up. There was one thing that looked like a variation off of the Quatermass experiment monster that was in the church.
Yes. Yes, it did. Yeah.
And then there was some kind of a weird, I don't know, halfway between a bird and a plant in there, and a couple of other weird creatures making all these weird noises.
Stuff.
And they're finding all these chunks of meteor put in with the plants and put next to the creatures to see what they're capable of doing.
Yeah, Karloff's version of Miracle Grow.
Yeah, really. So, you know, it's one of those things where I can see that at one point in time they started running out of post stuff to do films for American International. So I think they started looking for other things, and one of them was Lovecraft. But I'd say that this film, while I do like it, I'd say it's a little less elegant than the Price, Corman, Poe films. Those are.
Oh, yeah. No, I think you're dead on with that. Yeah. It's a step down. It is.
I don't think Richard Matheson wrote the script to this, because it doesn't have any of
No, it wasn't Matheson.
It's pretty straightforward.
I can tell you the guy's name here.
It was pretty straightforward. It was pretty straightforward, you know.
It was Jerry Soule was the.
Jerry Soule. That's oddly enough. That's the guy. Isn't that the guy that wrote Frankenstein, the Frankenstein Conquers the World? Wasn't he the writer of that too, in the Japanese production?
You know, he may have been. You know, I didn't
check on him, I think it is. I think it's from a.
I know he'd written a couple of Star Trek episodes. He wrote some episodes of The Outer Limits.
I swear, I think he's. So the writer of the Price, Corman, Poe films was Richard Matheson, doing a great job. Yeah. This was. I still like the writing in this film, but it's Jerry Soule who.
Right.
I happen to have a personal affinity for some of his, you know, the Star Trek.
The writing of this is good. Yeah,
Outer Limits, but Frankenstein, Conquers the World, Frankenstein versus Baragon, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. He was busy doing television and books and stuff too, you know.
Absolutely.
And it's just funny.
I would say American audiences probably would recognize him more for his television work here, because he did it all of the Monster Kid television shows
that we
loved watching. He wrote episodes for him. So
I wonder if there is any sort of a connector between him and Nick Adams working in England though, and working in Japan.
I don't know. That's a weird... good question though. That I don't know. I there's not a lot written about Jerry Soule in the references that I had, except for what he had actually done, but not, you know, and that question was never answered. That's sort of intriguing.
And you said he did work on Star Trek a little bit.
Yeah, he wrote an episode of Star Trek, the original series.
Yeah, I remember the name. He worked for Star Trek people, but
he wrote three episodes. I'm sorry, I should have been more on top of that. So
you got the titles.
Corbinite Maneuvers.
Corbinite Maneuvers. Love that one.
Yeah, and The Side of Paradise.
That's another really good one.
And then in season two, we did Whom Gods Destroy. That was the last one that he wrote for Star Trek.
Well, I think Whom Gods Destroy is that third season, isn't it?
Or third season. I'm sorry. I can't read.
Yeah, that one's two. That one's not at the level of the other two. But of course, that's also third season production and quicker rewrites because
well, by then,
bailing. Yeah, was, they were bailing the people that we really liked who made the show as great as it was. A bunch of them had bailed, which was a tragedy.
But
that's one of their lesser third season episodes, middle. Or somebody else. Somebody will yell at me about that. I don't know, but I don't care. Said what I said.
Yeah. No. Well, they cut the budgets and everything. Oh, yeah. I mean,
it was like half.
Yeah.
And when Gene Kuhn left,
and then moved it to Friday night, which was the Kiss of Death.
Well, I mean, but you had people that were really. There was a real good system of checks and balances on the first two seasons.
It's true.
That just was gone by the third one, and. But so this is interesting. So, you know, as we get further along, we realize why the mother wanted the daughter gone. And that's because of this irradiation crap going on. Yeah.
Well, and it's even affecting Karloff to explain why he's in a wheelchair all the time.
Right.
And it's slowly affecting him as well, which surprised me because I figured he's around it more. I would have thought it would have affected him more, but I don't know. I guess everybody's a little different, you know, with the.
Well, at the end, you know, there's this chunk of meteor down in the basement inside a pit that is, strangely enough, is done in a Gothic style because of the previous, the earlier part family.
Yes.
You know, their forefathers or whatever being.
The Whitleys, yes.
Whitleys, was it Satanists or something? I can't remember what they did. They say what it was. It was something along those lines.
They hinted at that, yeah.
They didn't seem like the nicest people, but
That's why the townspeople did not care much for having anything to do with them.
So then the meteor is kept down in this well, which is kind of similar to what's in the book, is that this thing is down in a well and people are jumping in after it and everything. You know, near the end of the story, Karloff is there and he's decided he's going to destroy it, smash it to bits and everything like that. And he goes and smashes it to bit it, but at his own cost, it releases the radiation and turns him into this silver glowing creature, automaton of destruction that goes after Nick Adams.
Pretty cool effect for the budget they were on, though.
I remember really liking it. And Nick Adams and him go at it, you know, Nick's chucking stuff at him and running backwards a lot.
Right.
And him and Susan Farmer get out of the house after Karloff falls off this railing and hits the ground and kind of things blow up.
Yeah.
And then the house catches fire from it. And then the whole place goes up.
Which is another mark of Hammer Films. They ended
a lot of fires.
Movies,
yeah.
A lot of their movies with houses burning down.
Well, that's the question. was that and more to Hammer DNA possibly? Was that Oakley Court? Because Oakley Court's Brides of Dracula and several other Hammer films. Tim Curry, Time Warp.
Horror Picture Show.
Rocky Horror, thank you.
It was Oakley Court. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, it looks like it. It's a good, which is interesting for such a beautiful building. Of course, they have to do this to create the mood.
Yeah, yeah.
But out of Oakley Court, that one uses more fog than almost any film with Oakley Court I've ever seen. I have to kind of look and go, I think that's Oakley Court where they're filming.
You could tell it was familiar, but
they ran a lot of fog over to be part of the atmosphere.
And the camera angles were a little different too, to give it a little different impression.
Yeah.
I think so. Maybe Howler was just wanting to make sure people thought, oh, that's that one that was in that movie and that movie and that movie.
Well, it's also too, it's like the whole burned up forest and the meteor and the weirdness. It's supposed to create that atmosphere with all that fog. One of the things that I want to bring up too, and it's, you know, to me, one of the great set people of all time, one of the unsung heroes of Hammer, Bernard Robinson.
Oh, absolutely.
Incredible sets. Yes. Now, this guy, whoever did the sets, and these did a pretty good job too. I don't know who the set designer was, set decorator, but it, you know, for a an American International film, they did a pretty good job. I thought that the sets looked good. I don't know if they filmed inside an actual place or if they were built sets or whatever, but they did a pretty darn good job. There was plenty of unusual looking furniture and tapestries and rugs and beds and
beautiful sets. Yeah,
I mean, and they did a pretty good job. It had a look, you know, of it was looked like it was a lot of work put into it. So I thought it was pretty nice. That's just an aside.
Yeah, I didn't recognize the name. It was a Colin Southcott was the guy who did the art direction. And I was trying to get a pull up the camera crew here, or not the camera crew, but the set crew. But I, it looks like he did most of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did not recognize the name, so it didn't come to mind when you mentioned that.
Right. So what about you?
Kudos. Absolutely kudos for the work he did.
So what are the thoughts have you got about the film? I've been doing most of the talking.
I think the fact that, let's say I was relatively young. I mean, I was like maybe an early teenager or almost or a preteen when I saw it, like 12, 13 years old.
Yeah.
Really expecting to see a big monster. And when it was obvious that wasn't going to happen, feeling a little disappointed, but then the film kept me hooked. And then when they did reveal what was going on, then I was sort of into the whole radiation thing too, because we all were back then, because everybody figured out that's the way we're all going to die anyway. I thought that was pretty cool. And this film really stuck with me over the years. They didn't show it a lot. After I saw it that one time on Monster Movie Matinee, it was quite a while before I saw it again. I think it was probably almost in college before I saw it again.
I saw it about two or three times as a kid. And then
On where you were living.
At the saw time. It here and there. I saw it, I think, out of Atlanta once or twice. And then
no, I did. I know Turner had it. Yeah, I know Turner used to show it.
And then one of them was I saw it at the Silver Scream Spook Show. Professor Morte's Silver Scream Spook Show. And was a very interesting viewing of it, because I had never seen a movie. Well, I had seen a couple of movies that old on the big screen, but not that one, which I'd already seen multiple times on TV.
Yeah.
So when I saw it, I thought, okay, I'm just going to have a good time and I'm watching it. But in the giant theater with the giant image, especially when Nick Adams is walking around with a candle and stuff, and they're hearing noises and he's going through the house, I found myself to be a little bit in a spooky mood. It was sort of like,
I would have loved to have seen this on the big screen. Yeah, this is one
really
I did
does
not see on the big
work
screen.
The way it doesn't on TV. I mean,
it's a whole different feel. And then you got an audience in there that you're pulling off of.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part that people don't, you know, quite understand. Well, you got big screen TVs nowadays and stuff, but it's different when you're in that auditorium and you're feeding off of, you know, if you've got a bunch of people in there that are feeling spooky or creepy, it affects you. I mean,
encompassed.
Yeah, you become part of that dynamic. And I think it really adds to a film.
I will say I was very glad to be able to watch it again the other night. Originally, I was going to watch it here in the studio on one of the small TVs. And I said, no, and I'm going to go in and watch it.
Yeah, watch another big one. Yeah.
On the big TV with the new, you know, Linda got a new stereo sound system for her.
Nice.
I think 25 years of service at her job.
Nice.
And she got a very nice sound bar sound system out of it. So we, you know, got hooked up. And so I had it up cranked up and everything. And it was really fun to watch it the other night. Crystal clear picture. Nice sound and everything, just really good. Sometimes movies that, I hate to say this, the old thing of when we were little kids, if we were lucky to see one of our favorite monster movies on a 12-inch television set, we'd be happy.
Yeah, you got that right.
But that's the
19 was huge, you know.
Yeah, 19-inch TV set, 21 was a monster.
Yeah,
and
if you were
like,
rich, you got a 25-inch, you know, but that was about as big as it got.
And you had this, what do I call it? A sort of a, I'm taking in the information. Okay, I watched King Kong on a 12-inch television set one time, not the first time, but the second time, and I was grateful taking it, or watching a color film on a black and white TV just so that you could see it. You know, it was like, okay, I'll take this, you know, and I'll take this. But nowadays, with some of these films, you sort of look at something like Die Monster Die, and you go, you know, this really benefits from the fact that somebody's got a, and it wasn't the best restored copy. There were still some pops and scratches on it, but it was like getting a very, very good print of it being used, and watching it and enjoying it, letting it encompass you, having the sound way up, you know, hell, even making popcorn while you
Absolutely.
watch it and everything.
Well, now
And
the color in the film really does enhance it, because the first viewing I saw of it was in black and white. And then when I saw it
Me
again,
too.
we
Me
had
too.
a 25 inch. That's why I was thinking it was near college. I may have been like a senior in high school or something like that, but we had a 25 inch, a big TV in the rec room. And then that's the next time I saw it, which was, I think, was on Sunrise Theater, if I'm not mistaken. Like you were saying, we might have watched the same showing of it, and it was like, wow, that was even that enhanced it so much, especially with the glowing, because it was sort of a greenish type glow, and then at the end it was sort of a silvery blue green or whatever. I mean, it was just they made good use of color in this film,
Yeah,
and the set design definitely did too. It really helped set the tone for how spooky it was.
Nice little monster movie potboiler.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, technically you do have a couple of kind of monsters. You've got the wife and the other girl that's sort of
Yeah,
irradiated,
yeah.
and then at the end when Karloff comes back as a silver
Yeah.
creature of destruction, it's definitely a monster. But you know, but in terms of like a monster coming off the table in the lab the first 10 minutes, and that's the problem, the whole thing through the
Right,
whole film.
right.
No, it wasn't like that.
No,
So,
no.
yeah,
Or
I'm
what,
trying to
like a
think of any.
monster from outer space? So, I mean, it wasn't even
Right.
like the Quatermass experiment, which I ironically, you mentioned that because I just watched that this week as well. Just I got in the
That's a
mood
great
for,
movie.
yeah, and I wanted to, just the copy I had was not a good restored copy, and I was able to catch
Oh.
it on a 4K release on a streaming service. So it was like, oh man, this is good looking.
Yeah.
It looked
Yeah, the
really
restored
sharp.
version I've got's real nice. I've got
Yeah.
all of the Quatermass films on the, you know, restored, and
Yeah, I want to
it's
sit down and
excellent.
watch two next because I've got
Yeah.
access
So
to
that's
a
another good
4K on
film. It's
that.
good. They're all good.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Well, okay. Was there any stone we left unturned?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, again, the story is very simple. It's very quick. This movie moves very, very fast, I think. And you got a little, I don't want to say it drags in the beginning, but no, you have your little bit of setup, but it's only an hour and 20 minutes, so they pack a lot in pretty quick. Once you meet all your main characters, and including the doctor, I'm including in that, as well as Susan Farmer and Karloff and Freda Jackson, and then the guy playing Merwin, the butler, all of those guys, then it moves along pretty quickly.
Yeah, I don't think the movie has too much drag. It's
Yeah.
it, you know, guy shows up in town, everybody wants him to go away.
Yeah.
You know, gets out to the place they don't want him to go to. The only thing that might be a little strange is that he did go back into town to talk to the doctor. I was almost wondering, like, you know, I'm surprised in a way they didn't do that at the beginning,
Yeah.
but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. That's probably not really even a valid
Well,
criticism.
I guess they almost had to do it that way, because in the beginning he really didn't know what was going on. And then once he had been out there and saw just how w strange it really was, then he had something to go back to ask the doctor about, say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on? Because that's when he learned about all the ancestors, all the portraits on the wall, and she was filling him in a little bit on some of the strange stuff that had happened in their family over the years. And so it gave him a reason to go back in there to find somebody who would actually tell him
Yeah,
something.
they had to get a little bit more
Yeah.
information.
So, I
Yeah,
mean,
you're
no,
right.
yeah, that one worked all right.
Plus, I was just glad to see the actor, so
Oh, yeah, man.
that's
Yeah.
good.
Yeah. Because, yeah, he's such a good guy.
Yeah.
Good guy to watch. So,
well,
cool. Yeah. No, I guess the one thing as a kid I sort of liked was it was one of the first monster, quote unquote, monster movies I saw that I thought was going to take me in a particular direction. It took me in another one, but I was very pleasantly surprised it took me where it took me. So yeah. Up until that point, they were all pretty straightforward and
right.
I hadn't really seen one that you know, and then those became some of my favorites. I said, you know, I remember telling friends of mine who weren't really monster kids when we would go see them in the theater, they'd say, well, what do you want this movie to be like? And I said, it's got to fool me. I want it to surprise me. You know, I want it to not, you know, I don't want to be able to figure it out like 5 minutes into the movie. And this one, I couldn't do that. It was one of the first that, so it became a little more memorable because of that, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I remember actually, I think when I saw, I know exactly what you're talking about. My feeling was when I started watching it, it was going to be just a gothic with some kind of curse or something.
That's what I thought too. And it was all leading up to that. Yeah.
And it turned into science fiction.
Yeah.
As we went along, which, you know, I'm not saying science fiction is better necessarily because there's great, great horror films and great movies.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
But I, at least there was a tangible, some kind of a very solid thing I could hang on to as to what, yeah.
I mean, at the age I was when I first saw this, I was huge. I mean, I was going all sci-fi. I mean, I was just going nuts for sci-fi at that time. Sure. You know, I'd been 12, 13 years old. And of course, the influence my mother had, because, you know, and folks have heard me tell, you know, how she was influenced by her father, who was a huge Jules Verne fan and Edgar Rice Burroughs and, you know, all those guys. And she got me into it very, very quickly with Tom Corbett, with the Tom Corbett books, one of the first sci-fis I read.
Sure.
And a couple of others. So, yeah, I was really cooking. You know, I loved my monsters, but I was really into sci-fi big time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And plus you had the space program in the United States was really kicking into high gear at this point.
Right.
You know, John Glenn had just orbited the Earth and we were trying to see if we could get to the moon by the end of the decade. And, you know, for the memory of JFK and his challenge to everyone. So, yeah. So when this had a sci-fi type ending, it was like, awesome. I was all there. I was all in on that.
Okay. Well, sounds good.
All right. Well, we got some more coming up with Mark, and now our schedules are getting a little more less crazy so that we can get together for a few more here and there. Mm-hmm. We've been having some discussions on some fun ones down the road, folks. And we are coming up pretty close now on our 8th anniversary. We'll be getting ready to start season number 9. Unbelievable, folks. That's coming up in just a few weeks, in less than 2 months from now. We'll be having that in a very special movie for you on that one. I'm just going to keep you teased and not give that one away. So, Mark's always fun.
Cool.
It's like the old days when we get together here.
Well, if anybody's interested, they can go and
say, what you got coming up? What you doing?
Oh, magazine covers. I think I even mentioned one earlier, the Frankenstein cover. Yeah. But, you know, you guys can see my work and stuff up on maddoxplanet.com. I've got some book covers too. I can't really tell.
It's a store too as well.
I've got a store up
there. You're the anti-Sven Gulli. Instead of saying, I've got a store, it's like, I've got a store.
Yeah, really? Yeah. And, but you know, it's funny. It's pretty much I've got plenty of covers and artwork to do and everything like that. But the thing is, you always allow your publisher or whoever, your writers or whatever, to announce it. But I just said the one, because Richard Clemenson never really kind of keeps it a secret as to what's happening. So Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell will be coming from Little Shop of Horrors.
Nice.
an issue with that in it, and some action adventure books, a couple of horror books, a couple of horror history books, and then more private commissions. It's fun stuff, painting monsters and vampires and things like that. Yep. So,
first Mark's going to be at Monsterama in August, and we just got to confirm
and
that
we will
be having a Monster Attack panel.
Thank goodness.
As well. And our panel has grown a little bit because I'm hoping now that Shane Morton has been sitting in with us on so many shows that he'll be able to sit in with us on the panel.
Shane,
as well.
Shane.
Oh,
Shane,
yeah. Shane, I think he will. Shane.
Madeline will be there probably, and we got to get Clay Sayer, hopefully Clay.
There. Clay will be there as well.
And, excellent.
Yeah. We're slowly getting things worked out where I can get – I've got a couple of movies I want to do with Clay. Clay just relocated to another state, so I was given a little time to get settled in there. Yeah, you know.
Traitor.
But anyway, yeah, so Mark, August 9th, 10th, and 11th.
Yes, sir.
For Monsterama. It's at the same location that we were at last year, the Hilton Northeast Atlanta, or Atlanta Hilton Northeast, however you want to call it. It's on Piedmont Industrial Boulevard. So get your tickets now, and the rooms are going fast. So don't miss out. It's always a lot of fun. A great lineup this year.
Oh, it's the Monsterama is always fun.
Yep.
Always have a great time.
Yep.
Cool.
So, folks, have a great week. And guess what? We will see you next Monday.
Oh, man. There's so many new movies and TV shows out. How do I decide what to watch?
Well, you should check out Cigar Nerds Podcast. They discuss all the latest movies and shows.
Wow, but also I need to keep up with the latest cool things that are coming out as well.
Don't worry, little Billy. They also cover the latest in nerd and pop culture news.
Wow, thanks, Radio Voice Guy. Where do I find these nerds?
That's easy. At CigarNerdsPodcast.com.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.